Hey, everybody. This is Richard Deitch. Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producer, as always, is Lou Pellegrino. Coming up on this episode, it's Bob Lee and Jeremy Schapp of ESPN. Starting on May 14th, Bob and Jeremy will be fronting E60, which launches a weekly Sunday morning edition. That's the first time E60 will air live and on a year-round basis in a regular time slot. Very good news there for journalism. And we will talk about that as well as the ESPN layoffs with Jeremy Schapp and Bob Lee. All right, as I said at the top, we bring in Bob Lee and Jeremy Schapp. They are part of the new E60 Sunday show, which will debut on May 14th. That is the launch of a weekly Sunday morning edition. You, of course, know Bob Lee and Jeremy Schapp from their many years working at ESPN on many journalism projects. Bob Lee and Jeremy Schapp, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thank you, sir.
Good to be here.
All right, let's start off with this. We'll get to the E60 stuff, but obviously the overarching story for ESPN over the last 10 to 12 days, and this is not something I have to tell you guys about because you're living it, and that is the loss of 100 staffers due, or about 100 staffers due to layoffs, many of them, most of them, in fact, people with journalism backgrounds and experience. Bob, I'll start with you. How difficult a week has it been at ESPN for staffers who care about journalism?
It's been a very difficult time, and it's a personal, I think, loss more than anything than necessarily professional. And to tell you, to give you an example of how all of us have certainly taken it personally, I spent a portion of the weekend speaking with several colleagues who are not with us, but it went down on Wednesday with the 25th. I that afternoon, after we did our show, drove to New Haven, got on the Acela, went down to Philly to do the draft. We did three shows in Philadelphia, and while I'm on the Acela, I had people coming up to me in the car just offering their condolences to me because they knew that I had lost, the company of a lot of friends and colleagues. So that gives you some kind of a dimension, I think, of how our audience, which I think has great loyalty still to this place, sees the loss of some of these people. I've heard the discussion about the damage to journalism. I don't buy that at all. I think the enterprise Jeremy and I are engaged in, I think, belies that storyline. I see it in personal terms.
Yeah, there is the personal, there's the professional. My thoughts the last 10, 11 days have been about friends, colleagues who've lost their jobs, how they're going to support their families, all that stuff. And when it happened that Wednesday, I was on the road doing a piece, and I was following on Twitter just like everybody else, and some of the names shocked me. People I've worked with for decades, and it's painful. In terms of the journalism that we do here, I think we're as committed as ever to being in the news gathering business, breaking news, doing enterprise work. I think all of that commitment is still there, and the size of the news gathering operation, I think, the overall size is still, it's huge. It's huge how much we do.
Bob, listen, there's no doubt that ESPN still is going to do great journalism. I think if you pretend that's not the case, you're either a competitor or you're just playing games. But I do want to play devil's advocate with you as something Jeremy just said. How would you answer to those who point to Ed Werder, Jason Stark, Ethan Strauss, Jane McManus, Andy Katz, Brett McMurphy, and the list goes on? How do you answer the question to say, how can ESPN's commitment to journalism be as great as it was when you have just lessened your journalism organization with hundreds and hundreds of years of experience specific to journalism?
Look, everybody you just elicited in that rundown, and there are many more names, have done outstanding work, and I've spoken to some of those people, and will continue to. Listen, there are going to be those moments when we on outside the lines, and we're there 5 days a week. Here's that topic: we need so and so, or we need such and such. I will tell you that going into Philadelphia for the last day of the draft, we had pre-booked three guests for that show. All three were caught up in the layoffs. That's an inconvenience for us. That's a tragedy for each of them and their families. Listen, it's going to take a deep breath and a bit of a reimagining of some things. Things aren't going to be as they were. But what we have still, I think, is by comparison the largest news gathering organization, both for daily and spot news, and I think for deep dive, long form journalism. We're going to miss the people professionally and personally, but the decisions made, it's one of born of financial concerns, of delivery systems, of platforms, and has an eye on the future of the marketplace with factors. And when the statement is made by management, it had nothing to do with quality of work. That evidently has to be the case because everybody that I'm familiar with caught up in this did outstanding work.
Jeremy, and I know Bob's going to weigh in on this too, but I'll start with you. There has been, you know, I'm someone obviously, given that I report on this stuff, I read far too much about media and particularly sports media. And I have read now thousands and thousands of words where people are positing the notion that the layoffs in part were a result of the ESPN shift politically to the left. As I've written many times, and everybody who listens to this podcast knows, in terms of the business side, I think that is absolute horseshit. There is, though, no doubt that there is a narrative out there, and perhaps bigger than I thought, of people who have a less feeling, a positive feeling about ESPN because they believe that the network, and that this is an incorrect belief, but they believe the network is doing too much progressive style news and sports. Everything's Caitlyn Jenner, Arthur Ashe, etc. I know, Jeremy, you have read all these pieces, and you've
not
seen,
all of them. I am not quite as obsessed with the topic as you are, but I've read
okay.
some of them.
So here's my question to you: what do you make of this? These stories that are put out there, many obviously in the conservative press, but certainly many by your competitors too. What have you made of the idea or the notion that ESPN is in its position because it has shifted left politically?
I what was the word you used? Horseshit. May I say horseshit too? I think it's ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense in terms of the way that people give up cable if they're cutting their cord. I mean, think about it, right?
It's laughable.
Right, Richard? Like, I don't think there's a way to cut your cord getting rid of ESPN without getting rid of your Fox News or your other outlets. I think this is a technology issue. I don't think it's an ideology issue. I think we're experiencing rapid change in the cable model. But I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Hasn't Fox lost more subscribers than we've lost over the course of the last year?
It would depend on the metrics that you use, depending month versus month, year over year. You could spin it either way, given you guys have lost more at certain times and they've lost more at certain times.
Well, as I suspected, you know more about it than I do. But I just don't feel that that is something that has had an impact on the layoffs, on the cord cutting. I did see some indication that Republicans, people identify as Republicans, I don't know if they were registered Republicans, if they vote Republican, however they were identified, have shifted somehow in their sentiments about ESPN. But, you know, this is difficult now. There is no question. I would be lying if I said that over the course of the last year and a half, there has been the same amount of political engagement on the part of our people on air on social media as there had been in the previous 10 years. You know, the whole country has been politicized in a way that it hasn't in generations. We're living in a time, I mean, you know, I follow you on Twitter. Certainly you've been engaged discussing politics in a way over the course of the last year and a half that you had not in the previous 10 years or whenever you got on Twitter. If you're looking at the social media feeds of people on air at ESPN, a lot of them, there's a lot out there, and there's a lot on the left side of it. But how that translates into the on-air product and cord cutting, I'm not sure.
I mean, there are two separate issues, Rich. There's two separate issues. There's the financial and business challenge, the platforms, the future path of this network in telling its stories and distributing it. That's separate and apart from the political leanings. Now, is there a liberal culture at ESPN? Undoubtedly, yes. It's inarguable. We're a mainstream media outlet in the Northeast. It's like saying, is Villanova, is Seton Hall, St. John's, are they a Catholic university? I mean, it just is. They don't gather nefariously in a closet to plot Marxist-Leninist propaganda. It's just what is. And Jeremy talked about social media. You and I, Rich, had this discussion. I spoke at your graduate-level course at Columbia University about a month and a half ago about people in the public eye who are journalists and reporters tweeting their private political beliefs. And I think you and I see it a little bit differently, but I don't see that, whatever the realities are, and I've talked about the need for greater diversity of thought here, and I stand by that, I have trouble balancing my checkbook, but what I know about the financial side is I cannot see it affecting the greater issue of cord cutting, of platforms going forward 10, 15 years out, which is where this company has to be looking.
Bob, I want to follow up with you. What did you make of your longtime colleague, Linda Cohn, who I imagine is a longtime friend? If nothing else, putting it out there in the public sphere that the company has antagonized people because of, at least in her opinion, some political thought, takes, ideology, et cetera.
Well, listen, I'm sure Linda sees what I see on my Twitter feed on the times I go to the mention tab, which is increasingly rare. So if you want to, if you're loading up your verbal shells and whatever, this either way, what we either of us has said, rest assured, I rarely check the Twitter mentions. I'm sure Linda has seen.
Smart.
In the wake of especially Wednesday's announcement, what I saw, which was liberal ESPN getting what it deserves, and anybody who speaks in those terms, God bless you, but you're also revealing where you're coming from. So if you think we have an agenda, well, there's an agenda on the other side of the equation. And I think Linda saw a parallel. I don't see that parallel between political points of view or just the environment. It's nothing, as I said, there's no master plan here, folks. It's just the environment of working in the Northeast, in New England, in a mainstream media environment, in an inclusive atmosphere where a lot of things have been out in the public eye. But as I said, and I was just quoted today in the Hartford Current, Black Lives Matter. Well, Blue Lives Matter, too, especially if you know someone in law enforcement. Those two should not be mutually exclusive. You should encourage discussions when you get to the sports component of that problem that acknowledges that. Conservatives should not be treated like these rare prehistoric animals that have to be nurtured because there are so few of them. Well, look, last November, you may disagree with the results of last November's election, but that is a reality.
And I should say, Richard, I happen to know a lot of my colleagues up here who are conservative, who do vote Republican, who though I feel have been less vocal on social media than their liberal counterparts, for the most part. I think they feel they're more inclined to keep things to themselves, or have been over the course of the last year and a half. And I don't think that's because of a fear of retribution or this or that. I think it's the nature of the specific people I'm talking about.
Wait, Jeremy, you know some rich executives in Connecticut who voted for Donald Trump? I'm surprised about this, Jeremy.
He didn't say executive. you're putting words in his mouth.
You're
putting words in my mouth. I wasn't even thinking about executives. I really was thinking about, people who are not at that level, but yeah, you have a point as well.
I know some executives who voted for Trump. That's what I'm saying.
Which in New England was a wasted vote. But, if you want to vote that way, vote your conscience. That's why we have these rights.
Absolutely. all right. One of the here's the last thing I sort of want to delve into on this before we get into what you guys are doing. And I'll start with you, Bob. Given that you hosted SportsCenter, I don't know when the first time you did it, but we're talking decades and decades.
September 10th, 1979, shows.
Today's VE Day, right? It was right after the surrender in Europe. It was
We're taping that on this day.
Marconi walked in and said, guys, this one's going to be in color. And Vladimir's working said, the tubes are up to the temperature. We'll do it this way.
Nice. Bob, your first guest was Eisenhower, right?
He was only a lieutenant then.
Hey, I had Eisenhower on my podcast a few months ago, but it was David.
Ah. Well, I had David 25 years ago on a show we did, the presidency.
Nice.
So by the way, I believe presidential trivia might be, how many men have been in the room when two presidents have passed away?
He's the only one.
Yeah, Nixon and when Eisenhower each passed away, David was in the room.
That's
amazing.
That is amazing.
Anyway.
Former baseball writer. Yeah. David Eisenhower.
Wow, did not know any of that. Bob, where do you, you know, it's very clear that there's been a shift at ESPN, of course, to sports centers that are personality-driven first, conversational elements of pop culture and other stuff, where in the old days, of course, I don't know if this is the right phrase, but I'll use it anyway, where SportsCenter was sort of apolitical in terms of what you were going to see, straight highlights, giving you a catch-up of all the national games that you might not have seen, the greatest plays of the day. So there's been a dramatic shift now where SportsCenter is revolving around Scott Van Pelt, Jemele Hill, and Michael Smith. You guys don't have to confirm this, but obviously at a certain point, Mike Greenberg in the morning. What do you make of this, Bob? Because you've lived through this shift of SportsCenter, which forever has been the sports show of record, and now to a whole new generation, it's something totally different.
Well, it has to be something totally different because the landscape from 1979 or 1985 or 1994 doesn't apply anymore. It's adapt or die, and SportsCenter, I think, to its vast credit, the people who visualize and organize and administrate the show look at the landscape, look at the challenges of we've talked about, cord cutting, how many channels you have. I mean, how much live television do you watch at home? I will tell you, it's an embarrassingly small number for me. Having just, you know, billions was it for the weekend. Everything else was time-shifted for me. Hmm. So they have to adapt, and they have to, I won't say try, but accomplish their mission differently. So I applaud it. I embrace it. I think you're seeing some of that we're trying to do with Outside the Lines. I think there's a little bit more opinion orientation on stories where there is latitude to do that, not the stories where obviously you have to be reporting it straight down the middle. But there's a little bit more opinion in our show too. I think you need to distinguish yourself in the marketplace. So yeah, the sports. If SportsCenter, you know, everyone waxes nostalgic as well. They should if they read Jim Miller's book or they go old YouTube clips. Hey, that was the day, Dan and Keith, and it was great. And old clips of myself and Chris and Tom and whatnot. But spend 5 minutes watching it, and you say to yourself, that's Flintstones television as far as technology, the presentation, the way we're trying to grab your attention. So they, because I really don't work the show on a regular basis, they have to adapt. They've done, I think, a pretty damn good job of it.
Jeremy, this was an interesting weekend for you, given that the sports reporters has finally left its air. People know how I feel about the sports reporters. We don't need to go into that. More interested in your take. It must be I don't even know what the word would be, Jeremy. It must be odd in the sense that your dad put that show on the map, and he was a brilliant host. My issues with the sports reporters have nothing to do with Dick Schaap. But you are then coming into this spot now on Sunday morning. So the show that your dad really came into so many people's homes with, you're essentially replacing. That must be, is that an odd thing, just given that you grew up with the sports reporters, and I'm sure, you know, your dad would come home, and you're 8 or 7 years old, and he'd come home on Sunday, and that would be the show.
I was a little bit older. When the show went on the air, I guess I was 19, but I grew up with the show. It's been, it's been a part of my life, as it has been for many people, for 29 years. And so, yesterday I watched the last show. It had the most regular cast on, and I listened to the parting shots. And, it was, I was filled with sadness because, I love the show. I love the guys. And it's, it's gone now. And so it's been weird for me because, in particular, I'm very close to the producer of the show, Joe Valerio. We live in the same town. His grandkids and my kids play together. I've known him since I was a teenager. And so there's an awkwardness there because, you know, our new show E60 with Bob and me, is replacing it. At the same time though, you know, I'm excited about what's coming. I think this is a great opportunity for all of us who, you know, are in the storytelling, hard news, component of what we do at ESPN, and we're excited about this. I was on the Sports Reporters probably half a dozen times this year, knowing that it was going away, and you know, it always meant something to sit on that set where my father spent so much time, and he loved that job. He loved doing that job. Hosting that show was, you know, a lot of fun. I got to be a panelist a number of times, I think, with my dad before he died. So it's a big part of my life, and whenever things move on or are canceled, however, you know, I don't want to be euphemistic here, it's hard.
All right, I want to get into what viewers should expect from a weekly 60 on Sunday. You know, when we've come to watch E60, I think we have as viewers are used to features, you know, journalistically sound features that could run anywhere from, you know, 7 minutes, maybe you guys extend it to 11 or so, but it's very much in the, this is not the perfect analogy, but the sort of 60 minutes framework of features. From everything, at least I read about what is going to happen now, Jeremy and Bob, this is sort of a hybrid, right? This is not just the show that you're going to have on Sunday isn't sort of just a straight E60, but there's going to be other elements as well, correct?
Absolutely. And you know, the show will vary from week to week depending upon what the major pieces in the show will be. The great boon of this, it gives E60, which has done exemplary work for a decade, but has wandered, you know, across,
as my people did for many.
Well, I was actually going to go for. I talk about my people like a ping pong ball or a ball of the Jersey Shore in one of the raffles there. But so we both go for the ethnic tie there. But the show has wandered, and now it's got a home. And I'm getting emotional about that. 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings, but it will, I think, combine. I think you will see features that combine, you know, OTL's reporting, branded as such, with E60's amazing ability to tell stories, and branded as such, with other elements in the show. And the first couple of weeks, I think you're going to have to watch it, I think, for a couple of months before you get the full stretch of things that we'll be able to do. And I think the thing that excites, I think, Jeremy and I the most, aside from Jeremy having a regular home every Sunday morning at 9 a.m., is the fact we'll have a chance to do stuff together on the show.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun for me, if not necessarily for Bob. But it is more of a true magazine show format in the sense that, you know, the segments aren't all going to be the same length. There's going to be shorter stuff. There's going to be quirky stuff. I mean, we've got a piece coming up. I hope I'm not giving anything away. We watched Bob and me. Bob and I watched this last week, I think, together for the first time in a meeting. It's a piece about the youngest ever qualifier for the National Spelling Bee. And, you know, I don't know, maybe it's 5 or 6 minutes, but I dare say it's the best piece of television I think I've seen all year. And, you know, so not everything. E60 has transitioned over the course of the last decade. At the beginning, most of the pieces were kind of that, you know, 8 to 12 minute range. Over the course of the last few years, it's been more like 13, 15, two parts, 26 minutes, over the course of two segments. I think we're going to have more range in terms of what we can do in length, tone, topic. The OTL component, the E60 component is going to make it more variegated.
One of the...
I love that word.
Yeah,
love that word.
That is a good... That's very much an SAT word there. One of the things that I hope exists, and I imagine it will, and let me just use the OTL piece from this past week, for example. The piece that you guys did on the Arizona field athlete, I should say, that was just engaged in a horrible situation with her threatening and violent coach. That was terrific journalism, and it speaks to sort of athletic departments not, in my opinion, my words, looking after its athletes as it should. Bob, these kind of stories will definitely still get sort of prominence front and center on a Sunday where a John Barr and a Nicole Noren, they're working on this. They're working on these kind of.
John reported it.
Yeah, they're working on these kind of pieces for weeks, months, and then eventually it airs on Sunday. That's where viewers can come to see that stuff.
We have week one out of the box. Steve Fainarou on the Syrian national soccer team. By the way, that very phrase connotes the conundrum of what is the Syrian national soccer team? What's the Syrian nation? It's in civil war. They've spent 8 or 9 months shooting from Germany, Bielefeld, Germany, a place I spent some time, I spent a year there 1 week. the Turkish-Syrian border, a Syrian home game in Malaysia because FIFA will not allow. I mean, we showed a selection of this at a meeting last week that included John Skipper, about 20 people in the room, and when it was over, there wasn't a sound because the air had been sucked out of the room. That's going to be a major component of our first week. But I've seen some other scripts and treatments on other stories in development that are equally as ambitious. And I can't get too specific. Trust me, I take it on faith. We've got a lot of good stories in the pipeline that are just as compelling as the one you saw last week. And I think... and they'll be branded as such. So people say, well, where's Sunday morning OTL? Well, it's part of the E60. And you know, what's happened behind the scenes too, Richard, I think equally as important, is that our executive producer, Andy Tennant, has brought these two groups of people, which I think we've all worked on this for the same department in different areas of the campus. We have brought together the staffs and the two cultures, and to the point where now we have weekly meetings jointly, looking at pieces, offering suggestions, which we didn't have 4 or 5 months ago. And I think the sum of these parts is much greater than the individual components.
Bob and Jeremy, how much ratings pressure do you feel? I mean, ultimately, there's going to be numbers that come every week. I imagine, you know, those numbers would be compared to what was in the 9 a.m. time slot before, but you know, this kind of stuff is different because you want people to watch, but inevitably I think there's a higher calling. So what has management sort of told you about ratings expectations, if they've given you anything?
Nothing for me. I mean, I've never really immersed myself in the rating stuff, and look, I know it's important, and we're not doing this for people not to watch. You want people to watch,
right?
You know, there's a reason that, you know, the first show starts with a piece about Dak Prescott. You know,
we're not stupid.
Right.
We're going to start with the Cowboys.
I it's obviously not a ratings play. The hope is that this kind of work, the storytelling, the journalism, will bring people inside the tent. But, you know, it's not... nobody that I know has talked about it. Well, certainly they don't talk about it with me.
I will tell you twice now, I've heard the question and answer at a very high level of the company. What are the metrics that will gauge success for the new E60? And the response has come affirmatively from a highly authoritative individual: make great content. I will also tell you that though the changes we've made in the daily OTL in the last year, which have been substantial, higher story count, a little bit more point of view in some things where that's required, a little fun at the end of the show, more aggressive in our bookings, which I think will be amplified, all of that, with our, we'll be using this new set, the set that debuts next Sunday, and then with OTL. Over the last year, quarter over quarter, in the key demographic, we're up 9% in OTL. That flies in the face of every expectation out there in television. So we pay attention to the numbers on a daily basis. When at 4 o'clock every day, when the prior day's ratings roll in, we pay attention and we look to see, did we hold the number? Did we raise it? And we'll do that with E60, but it's not the only determining factor whether that was a successful show. You know, the phrase is used here for years, do the right show. Now, if you've got competing stories on a daily basis, you're going to lead with the one that will draw more eyeballs. But some days, you know, I've been very pleasantly surprised in the last 3 weeks. Twice we've led our show with elements of the USA Gymnastics sexual abuse scandal, the Larry Nassar story, which can be a little off-putting and also may not attract, you would think, the largest audience. On each occasion, the last 3 weeks, we've either held or raised the number, which tells me we've learned how to tell a good story, present it, and also trust in the intelligence of our audience, and it's been rewarded.
Yeah. I remember when I used to host OTL Lot, backing up Bob about a decade ago, you know, we would do shows sometimes and would be influenced by, well, you know, let's talk about the Yankees today. You think everybody's interested in the Yankees or something like that. And then we'd always get the lowest ratings when we do a show that we thought was the show everybody wanted to see. I mean, trying to figure out what people want, obviously it's more art than science, but I think more than art, it's just throwing darts against a board sometimes.
Bob, for many years, it was very unclear, this is my words, where the OTL brand stood with management, given the many various changes in terms of lineups. You know, you'd be on ESPN one run, you'd be on ESPN 2 one run. Management and PR would talk a nice game about how important the OTL brand is, but when the rubber hit the road, you guys were being, you know, bounced around.
Exiled.
Yeah, left and right. Like, you know, I'm trying to think of a...
That's my word, by the way.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of an NBA player who's played for like 18 different teams. So it now seems like, in my opinion, they've made a real commitment here for at least the short, long term. Do you feel as sort of the face of the OTL brand that you are in maybe the best place you've been in a long time in terms of management's long-term commitment to OTL?
I think the wind is at our back. I think that we've been able to, you know, as I said, show some ratings increase. We've shown the ability to look objectively at what needs to change in the show, story count, pacing, presentation, a lighter touch or a more opinionated touch when needed. And that's been rewarded by people watching. Listen, I think President Obama said this to his staff the day after the election: history doesn't move in a straight line. Well, same thing applies to television. You know, getting from A to B, sometimes you're going to have to go around a couple of, well, we call them rotaries here in New England. In Jersey, we call them traffic circles. We also have jug handles in Jersey.
Which are such a pain.
Aren't they? Especially Route 22. But in any event, you know, it's not a straight line from here to there. And we've wandered a little bit like E60. I think we've passed at the same oasis on occasion.
Hey, I remember when we used to do OTL Live as part of the trifecta at midnight, for 20 minutes.
20 minutes.
How long did we do that for?
A while. And we'd walk up to that horrendous Studio C, which...
I almost froze to death.
Yeah, it was a horrible place. You'd see the rats scurrying away from the dumpsters. all for the book.
Yeah.
But no, it's been a long journey, Rich. I think we're very happy where we're at. I think the folks that run the place are happy with the show that's being produced, and I think everybody thinks it can even get better. This new studio offers us great, and with the studio comes a great graphics package, too. And I don't want to get too inside television, but...
Bob loves this stuff.
Oh, I love it. I just got out of a meeting this morning. Exponentially, I think, gives us different tools to tell stories. And we have to tell them that way because it has to play on a big screen. It has to play on your phone. It has to play to grab your attention. I mean, we're tweeting out there for what's used to exist. You know, Twitter exists. We've learned trial and error because there are no rules on Twitter to tweet, for example, not a 3-minute portion of our show, but 4 20-second excerpts of our show, because that's all you have time for at a red light or on a plane or, you know, over a cup of coffee. So,
fast lane.
Exactly. It's a learning process, but no, I think we're in a very good spot, and we're looking forward.
Before I get to some reader questions for you guys,
exciting!
Yes, exciting.
Family feud here.
Right? I did want to ask you: this is for either of you? Is there like a white whale story for you out there? Something that you've both wanted to either do either on OTL, E60, in some other forum that for whatever reason you just have not been able to do based on timing, logistics, something else?
And tell you and let someone else
right.
do it?
Well,
what do you think? We're nuts?
Yeah, that's probably not somewhere I think we want to go right now. I mean, for a long time, I'll tell you what was my white whale, and we finally nailed it down, I want to say about 4 years ago, but for about 7 years, I was kind of semi-Ahab with the Mike Danton story, which to me, I mean, I know north of the 49th, it's a much bigger deal, but when it happened, when Mike Danton hired a hitman to kill his agent, mentor, coach, David Frost, I was just like sucked into that story. I covered it right when it happened for a few weeks, went up to Canada, and then over the course of the next several years, just kept knocking on the door to get both of them to talk to us, and we finally got that, and that felt good.
I'll couch something that I think I've spoken to in your class. Your class is off the record, unlike this recording that we're making on the record. But I'd love to flesh out the tip I got once, which seemed to have a little bit of substance to the, shall we say, influencing of a major sporting event. I can't be any more specific. Maybe you'll recall it. I hate to tease people like that, but that would be nice.
And I'll speak in general terms also, Richard. You know, at E60, we've done a lot of reporting from the Middle East, from the Gulf states. There's still a story there, a human rights story, a large story that we're hoping to tell, and been working on it, for a while. That's very vague, but that's part of the world where we've spent a lot of time. We found a lot of stories from Israel, Bahrain, Qatar, Oman, Saudi Arabia. That's something we're working on.
Well, Qatar obviously is going to be in the news as long as they have the World Cup. So
well, they're not losing it.
Yeah,
no. They're keeping it. That boat sailed.
All right, here are let's go with some reader questions. I'll get you guys out of here in about 10, 12 minutes or so. Bob, for you, have you ever seriously considered a job outside of ESPN?
Oh, yeah.
You want to be you want to elaborate you want to elaborate on that, Bob?
There was this would be now, oh my gosh, 21 years ago,
96. Small operation called
CNNSI was starting up just as my contract was lapsing, and we had some very sensitive conversations, and but there have been other occasions. So I always say this beats working for a living, but not to the exclusion of reality. You get to a certain point in your life where you're not going to pick up and move, but when you're on 17, by the way, it's a par 5, and the water put a lot of balls in the hole, so I'm not sure how long 17 and 18 are going to take to play, but back then, yeah, you'd be crazy not to. Otherwise, you're letting them take you free. It's still a business. They're running a business, and my career is a business.
I thought I was heading to CNNSI, too, in the summer of 96.
You too?
No
yeah,
kidding.
You never told me that.
Oh, I thought you knew.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, no,
Steve
and Gene and Jim offered me a job as the Chicago reporter for CNNSI. And I thought I didn't have an offer from ESPN at the time, so I thought I was going. And then I was at the Olympics working for NBC, and Vince Doria called me and offered me the Dallas job, which had come open because Pam Oliver had left for Fox.
Wow.
And so I stayed, obviously.
Who knew? We could have been colleagues of
the sort.
Been.
Yeah. Instead of what we are.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, do you know what a disastrous career move that would have been for either of you two had you taken that job?
How about this? I can top that. 1979, I had two job offers on consecutive days. On Friday, Scotty Connell, 2 weeks exactly to the date of the sign-on, offered me a job up here and was stunned when I walked to the door with him and didn't accept immediately because I have another job interview tomorrow, Mr. Connell, and I did from New Jersey Public Television to be their New York and Philly. They were on the air in both markets to be their weekend anchor and to be their week side sports reporter. On the air in New York and Philly, money was virtually identical, didn't have to move. I'd be on the air in New York and Philly at the age of 24. In retrospect, oh, it's an easy decision. Back then, no, it wasn't. Easily, most people presented those options with a startup that was like a blueprint or staying put, in where they were living, might have made the other choice.
This question came up from multiple people, and it's sort of it all revolves around the same thing. A lot of it was for Bob, but Jeremy, I think you would provide some interesting insight as well. And that would be, what do you tell journalism majors or young reporters? And I had a couple of people who work at ESPN who asked this, young people. What would you tell them now about today's media landscape, especially in the wake of the fact that you just lost 100 colleagues? Do you tell them to continue to stay in the business? Will there be jobs for them? Or if you were imparting wisdom on them in 2017, what would you tell them?
Are you talking about sports specifically?
Yeah, sport to have some kind of career in the sports media, be it whatever medium that would be.
I mean, I really feel when I do speak to, you know, college classes, stuff like that, I encourage them because I think that there are still a lot of opportunities. I was always taught, you know, do what you love doing because then, you know, it never feels like you're working. And my father certainly never felt like he worked a day of his life as hard as he worked. And I always figured, why would you want to do anything that you don't love? And so I would never discourage someone. I would say in a lot of ways right now, I mean, this isn't, some spectacular insight. There are more paths to getting good jobs in the industry than there have ever been. I understand the decimation of the newspaper industry, but there are fewer gatekeepers now. There are ways to, you know, get out. When I was getting started in the business, you know, when I graduated from college in 1991, you know, it was the middle of a recession of sorts. It was very tough getting jobs in the industry. Newspapers, I applied to, I don't know how many newspapers, didn't get. I got an agate offer, one place. It's always been tough to get a foothold in this kind of business that so many people want to work in, and there have been historically so few jobs. Obviously, ESPN kind of changed the paradigm. You know, I spent some time working in the network sports divisions as a freelancer here and there. And for decades, those guys, I mean, that was like skull and bones getting into NBC Sports or ABC Sports or something like that. And for decades, they thought of ESPN as, what's a polite way of putting it?
Some little pisher up in Connecticut.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I say if you want to do it, I tell people to do it. And that if you work hard enough, you're going to get your shot. And I believe that. I really do.
I would add to that, you need to be versatile. You just can't be writing. You have to understand the technology, the delivery platforms, the needs of potential employers. But I also would be encouraged that you can, I mean, my gosh, you can set up your own distribution channel or web. You know, the future belongs to those who, you know, make up their own rules. And you can become a presence and get your product out there without having a full-time job. I mean, the term is gig economy, and I see that. I've got adult children, and I see that in their own lives. I mean, the idea of working, I've been here for this company for 38 years. That ain't going to happen. My kids aren't going to have jobs for 38 years. I dare say many millennials listening is at 38 years, my gosh. it's been basically one job. So the whole landscape has changed. I think there's a great premium on those people with initiative and vision. And a lot of people that go into journalism, I think, have a premium on that.
Jeremy, is there anything you would change? This is another reader question. Is there anything you would change about your interview with Bob Knight?
You know, it's funny. I mean, it's been a long time. I haven't really broken it down. I've never watched the whole thing again.
Yeah,
I don't think so. I mean, if I take myself back to that time and Bob was on set that night here in Bristol throwing it to me, if I'm allowed for a moment to pat myself on the back, I think I handled it pretty well. I think it was
better than well.
I think I didn't make it about myself. When he made it about me, I brushed it off. I remember a couple of weeks later, or maybe it was that week, I got a call from Costas. He was down in Sydney, and he'd just gotten back from Sydney, something like that. He said, you know, great job, that was amazing, but you know what, when he said you got a long way to go to be as good as your father, I would have said, this is Bob talking, I would have said, well, you've got a long way to go to be as good as Dean Smith. And I said, I appreciate that, Bob, but I think that would have been the exact wrong thing to do. For me, as a 30-year-old kid, for him, you know, or for Bob Lee, or for somebody who's more established to kind of, you know, throw it back in his face, maybe that would have been the one thing. But I think the best thing to do was just to move on from that moment and continue the line of inquiry. I really do.
Yeah, well, you know what went through my mind sitting on the set watching that live, and I had that thought immediately, and it's never changed in 17 years, which was the only thing. My suggestion, what you could have said, would have been, we all do. We all have a long way to be as good as Dick Shepp, because Dick Shepp was the gold standard. And if Knight thought he was cutting Jeremy down, he was just stating a reality that Dick Shepp is, is above all of us in this profession. And I would have said, thank you. You've just complimented my father. But aside from that, no. You know, the best interviews are those when you're down the middle, fair, asking questions, and the person is doing a pretty good job of taking themselves apart. That happened to me with Lance Armstrong about 10, 12 years ago, who walked away from an 8 or 9 minute interview on OTL telling mutual acquaintances how much he enjoyed it. But, like, he essentially revealed himself to be the guy that eventually had to fess up to everything. You know, when you're able, and you did that with Knight, Jeremy, I mean, you just ask the questions, people reveal themselves, and the viewer can see it for themselves. You don't have to be in their face. It's not about us. It's about them.
That was the real Bob Knight.
Yeah.
Jeremy, did you ever interact with Knight while he was an ESPN college basketball analyst?
No, it's funny. You know, when he got hired, you know, I got a few phone calls. I made a couple of, you know, I thought they were pretty mild, snarky remarks in the press. But, you know, I think I know for a fact. All right, so one day, do I have time to go here?
It's a podcast, Jeremy.
So,
you can go
so
15
I'm out
hours.
In Vegas doing an E60 story, and I land, and I'm pulling out of the airport, and there's a billboard, I mean, the size of a football field. Join Billy Packer and Bob Knight at the Wynn, you know, all weekend. It happened to be the first weekend of the NCAA tournament. So I'm like, oh, great. And I'm staying at the Wynn. And I'm like, this is all I need. But then
the elevator door opens.
Right. But then I'm thinking to myself, what are the odds? It's like one of the five biggest hotels in the world. I'm never going to see the guy, right? So the cab pulls up like 10 minutes later. Bob's standing right there at the taxi line. Next day, I'm walking through the casino doing something with a producer, Sean Fitzgerald, and he's producing for Knight. And as I'm standing there, Knight comes right up to Sean, pats him on the back, and says, hey, when are we doing this live shot? Never acknowledges me, never looks in my eye, nothing. So that's the closest I came.
I thought he owed you an apology for what he's quoted as saying about you in Jim Miller's book, Tom Jones' book.
Oh, man. Yeah.
I was a little disappointed that the company didn't ask him to do that.
I was not surprised. I mean, by the comments.
Yeah, but yeah, I just thought that was, you know, if you're going to work in the same shop and have that, you know, you got to make that right. And it wasn't made right, and
Bob's not capable of that.
No.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned that, Bob, because Bob Knight called Jeremy Schapp a cocksucker, and I have to be...
Well, and I guess we're on the internet now, kids.
Right. And I have to be honest, there's no doubt that I enjoyed pointing that out to ESPN PR.
I noticed, management.
I mean,
the freedom of the podcast.
Jeremy,
by the way, kids, we're not doing that Sunday mornings.
Jeremy, I will say this. I'll say this today. I'll apologize now at this point for sort of using you as part of a campaign. I probably tweeted that fact that Bob Knight called you that in that book, I'd say conservatively 50 times on Twitter.
I think it was 75.
It might have been.
Compulsive from that. Yeah.
And Bob is correct. He never apologized. He should have.
Right. I mean, the one thing I would point out, and this is a distinction without a difference perhaps, I am under the impression, I never asked Jim Miller specifically, that he said that before we were colleagues. The book happened to be published after we had become colleagues. But I think the interview took place before he was working for ESPN. And trust me, I'm not making any excuses for Bob Knight, but I think that's the timeline.
I will just end that this part of the podcast with this. What a shitty hire by Norby Williamson. All right, let's move on.
There's a function.
Yeah. Here's.
Oh, man, we're going to hear about this.
Try not to. I'll try to. Your contracts are guaranteed. I feel like you're okay. Bob. One of the questions that came up, and this is sort of interesting because I don't know if there's an exact moment, but you would definitely have sort of some perspective. At what point during your ESPN tenure did you realize that, like, the network, the company, was a major part of people's lives? Was there a moment in the company's history where, like, you just were like, we are part of the terra firma the way, you know, whatever, Nike or whatever other big brand is?
Well, it's funny you mentioned Nike. Because the moment that immediately came to mind as I was listening to your question was the 1988 Final Four in Kansas City. I think
Danny Manning.
I think I have that recalled correctly. And this was at the end of, nearing the end of the 80s, when our growth as a network and the NCAA basketball tournament as a property, that same growth line. I've said this often, that if you chart that together, those two growths, they're the same. We were good for each other. Dick Vitale, the round-the-clock coverage, the cut-ins back and forth. And so we were set up at a mall there in Kansas City. And even before the incident I'm about to describe to you, I had a guy come up to me, an elderly gentleman, with tears in his eyes, saying, thank God for ESPN, and shaking my hand and, like, tearful with joy and gratitude that we were there and bringing him sports news. And that's what it meant to him. And that's kind of humbling. I mean, it's really is. And so in that same several days, we're set up there, and I'm sitting on the set with Dick. It was also the occasion, I think we also had Al McGuire and Billy Packer. I'm not sure if that was the same moment or not. Maybe just Dick and I doing the Sports Center. Several hundred, if not a thousand people surrounding us on several levels of this mall. And the door opens at the mall. I just happened to glance up, but we're maybe in a break, and in walked the guys from CBS, the production team, who we knew and had great mutual respect and affection back and forth. But the looks on their face when they walked in and saw the fan adulation for SportsCenter, for ESPN's coverage, for Dick Vitale, for everything we were doing, it was like, that was the affirmation, because there, for the entirety of the decade, there we were up here, Central Connecticut, starting out as a bit of a rumor, building bit by bit, evening by evening, you know, the rise of the Big East, which crested in 85 with three Final Four teams being from the Big East that year in Lexington. That was a big moment, but to actually see the impact on your competitor's face when they say, wow, look at this. And as I say, you know, other networks of viewers, we have fans, and our fans were there. And to see it impact on someone who was out there, you know, doing rightful, you know, business with us and crossing swords in the marketplace, that was important. That was a year after the NFL started. But for me, to see it with my own eyes, that was something.
Hmm. Again, you guys are not programmers, but I think you would have some interesting insight. I'll start.
Thank God.
Yeah,
you don't have the skills.
I'll start with you, Jeremy. Do you? I mean, what kind of like combination do you think works best for a sports network like yours between news, highlights, reporting, opinion, et cetera? Can you be between 6 a.m. and midnight? Can you be all things to all people? Do you have to sort of? Does it have to be more opinion than news? Does it have to be more news than opinion? How do you see where a place like ESPN, at least in terms of linear television, can be in 2017?
I got to tell you the truth. I haven't thought about these things like from a programming perspective. I'm just speaking extemporaneously. I think you got to be kind of all things. I think you've got to have news. I think you've got to have opinion. I think you've got to have storytelling. I think you have to do what OTL does on a daily basis so brilliantly. But, you know, I have friends in the business, friends here at ESPN, friends at other places who say, well, you guys should do a show like The Five on Fox, or you should do a show like, you know, that kind of, you know, you should do a show like, you know, Morning Joe. You should do this, that. I don't know. I really don't know what works, what doesn't work for our audience, our demographics. I would like to think there's room for all that kind of stuff. More than a decade ago, we were doing movies, we were doing scripted series. There were all kinds of other things. Is there the possibility that we might do more of that kind of stuff, especially if rights fees continue to climb and climb, but that complicates your relationship then with the entities? I don't know. I'm not good at that kind of strategic thinking in terms of programming.
You know, the problem with Playmakers was that it was totally beyond the pale. Could never have happened that way.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, except I lived in Dallas from 1996 to 1998. The stuff that happened in real life made Playmakers look like Sesame Street.
The thing is, look, we're a big tent. We need all those tent poles to hold up the tent. We need opinion. We need, oh, crap, he's going to hate us now, Jeremy. We need First Take.
What?
We need opinion like that. We need OTL. We need personality-driven sports centers. We need things that become appointment viewing, that stand out in the marketplace, because that is the present and that is the future. It's not just providing scores and highlights, because you can reach into your hip pocket. You're not pulling out a phone. You're pulling out a television studio. You know, with these apps, we can go on the air with our iPhone from anywhere in the world, and so we've got to respond to this marketplace where people expect things on demand quickly. Your app's got to load quickly and briskly. Your information's got to be focused. It's got to gather attention. If you're on Twitter, it's got to have an impact. It's got to have a good engagement rate. All of those things have to apply. What worked at the turn of the century doesn't work now. And what's working now probably will look a lot different in 5 years. And anybody who tells you what they know it'll be in 5 years is full of it.
Here's the last two. I'll start with you, Jeremy. In your years at ESPN, has reporting on the partners of ESPN in terms of the NFL, the NBA, et cetera, the leagues that you have a contractual partnership with, has that gotten easier, harder, or is it neutral? Whatever issues you might have had in 1995 are the same in 2017, or has that road become tougher to navigate in your position as a reporter reporting on stuff around that around these leagues?
24 years here. No one has ever said, pull that punch, don't go there, don't be aggressive with these guys because we have billion-dollar relationships with them. I mean, it's never happened. It's never gotten into my head that that's how you should be reacting to things. Because, you know, there's always the issue with those kinds of things. Like, it's not that somebody says something, but you kind of assume that you can't go somewhere. I mean, we have only become more aggressive as a journalistic organization over the last 24 years. I mean, to, you know, exponentially so. You know, I know that's a narrative. I know it's a narrative that's been out there for a long time. I just, it's never happened to me. I would be lying if I said anybody's ever in any way suggested there are some sacred cows.
Bob, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah. There is that wall between editorial and the business side. I think we have, you don't negotiate it, but you learn how to, I mean, look, you can't look at the reporting that we've done on the National Football League, go back to just to 2014 from the crisis of the Ray Rice moments and what Don Vanetta, Seth Wickersham, Adam Schefter, everyone, and on a daily basis, aggressively, fairly, looking at that, looking at the concussion issue in the National Football League, examining issues the way the NHL has dealt with concussions, baseball, whatnot, foreign players, international players there. I think we have, you know, if there is a concern, it does not reach us. It's dealt with at the highest levels. And I've said this publicly before, you know, when you're working on a story that involves a partner, you're probably knocking on the front door anyway looking for comments so that your reporting is not a surprise to them. But at the same time, as you get close to dropping a story and going with it on air, you let your business people, you have your bosses, have the other side of the company know it's coming, and alert the necessary party so nobody is surprised by this, because you've been seeking comment on it anyway. So it is... again, it's one of those narratives that is a comfortable narrative for some people to, you know, espouse, but it doesn't reflect reality. I mean, look at the product; it doesn't reflect it.
All right, here's the last one. You both can weigh in on this. I'll start with Bob. Bob, I think what's very clear under the John, people will praise John Skipper for things and criticize John Skipper for things, but I think the one thing that's generally clear is that he is a journalism person, and he has supported journalistic initiatives at ESPN for a long time as the president. Do you have a sense, Bob, of once John Skipper ultimately leaves ESPN, do you feel the commitment to journalism at ESPN and journalistic endeavors continues, or does it all go out the window when he leaves and whoever else comes in and has that chair?
Well, clearly, that's a binary question, and no. I mean, look, John is a content guy, a journalist. He has been very supportive of all enterprise journalism, and you know, he's been a great proponent of E60, of OTL, and throughout. And we had a presentation to him last week, and he was. I don't want to speak for John Skipper, but I think he was very satisfied with what he saw, because we had a conversation about it with a group of people. But remember, before John ascended to the presidency, and he worked in content, but even before that, George Bodenheimer ran this company, a very good friend of ours, and George was business-oriented. George understood the principles of journalism, but that was not he was not rooted in that. And we did some damn good journalism back then. I think What we've shown is that good journalism is good content, is good business. It's as simple as that. And at the same time, I think we've shown that, you know, good journalism is good content, is good public service. You don't have to do it, but it would be nice to think that whoever is here in 15, 20, 25 years still think we need to do it and should do it. And if that changes, a lot changes. And I don't think it will.
Yeah. If it changes, it's not the ESPN that we've known.
Well, it's not the America we've known either. I mean, because I mean, look at the cry for journalism here in 2017. If the journalists doing their job in 2017 have been on a job in 2016, history would have been written differently last year.
I mean, you know, journalism, storytelling, E60, OTL, all of the incredible reporters who continue to work for us. I mean, it is who we are. It defines us in a lot of ways. It's what distinguishes us as well from the competition. You know, I don't see it going away, but of course, you know, that's in my self-interest.
What did Knight call you? I couldn't believe you said that.
There were a few things.
All right, we'll leave this on a soccer note because both of you guys fancy yourself soccer people.
Go.
If you had to pick today, who's winning the 2018 World Cup and why?
Belgium.
Whoa, I like that.
Roberto Martinez. Our friend is now national team coach, so
I don't know. I haven't. That's hard to say.
I'd say Putin, frankly.
Yeah.
Clearly, Putin.
Putin. Russia finds a way to win. Look, it's Germany, right? Because it's a game with.
What did Gary Lineker say?
Right.
In 90 minutes, played by 22 men, and at the end of 90 minutes, the Germans always win.
Yeah, I like Germany. If you have to pick one against the field, it's Germany for
right.
me.
Germany and Belgium. I like those two picks. And Putin, of course, wins, although he didn't win in France, which was nice. All right, the guests have been Bob Lee and Jeremy Schapp, two of ESPN's best when it comes to sports journalism. I've known both for a long time, have immense respect for both. And Bob Lee has spoken to the class of Jay McManison I teach at Columbia many, many times, and the students always appreciate that. In terms of the
I spoke once when you were doing the class with Sandy. That doesn't get any mention.
Missed you like night.
Yeah, we've actually we now bring in Rosie Schapp instead of Jeremy Schapp.
Well, it is midday.
She's a tough yet.
Yeah, that's Jeremy Schapp's sister, by the way, fine writer in her own right. ESPN E60, I should say, begins its new era Sunday, May 14th at 9 a.m. That launches a weekly Sunday morning edition. It's the first time E60 airs live and on a year-round basis in a regular time slot, which is great news for that. And Bob Lee and Jeremy Schapp will be part of that enterprise, so you'll see them every Sunday, in addition to, obviously, the daily OTL show. And Jeremy Schapp will, I'm sure, be reporting from different places. You'll see his work on SportsCenter and E60. Gentlemen, I appreciate your time today. And, you know, obviously, I'll be objective and sort of let people know what I think of the show, but as someone who cares about journalism, I'm very happy this show exists, and I'm rooting for success. And I think you work with a lot of great people there, so I have no doubt the stuff will be compelling. Thank you very much for joining us today on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Our pleasure. And you're right, we front for a lot of extremely talented and dedicated people.
Thank you, Richard.
This is Sports Illustrated's Media Podcast with Richard Deitch.
All right, back in the studio with Lou Pellegrino. You know, Lou, I've interviewed Bob and Jeremy in many sort of different forums. As I mentioned, Bob Lee has talked to our Columbia class. I mean, these are two of the faces of ESPN's journalism. I do appreciate them answering the question because the question is legit. It's like there's no doubt that ESPN is committed to this show and committed to what Bob and Jeremy do. But at the same time, they laid off 100 people, many of which are journalists. So it's kind of a mixed message on the one hand. You're supporting this enterprise, which is really important work. On the other hand, you just laid off, you know, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 people, most of which have journalism experience. That's a mixed message there.
I guess it's a mixed message. Well, actually, not I guess. It is a mixed message, but when you have a show like OTL and what they do, for me, that's my favorite part of what ESPN does. It's that investigating, it's that deep digging story where you get to learn things, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. You get that respect and that professionalism from Bob and from Jeremy. And whenever Jeremy Schapp comes on TV, I stop. He has that ability, like his, much like his father had, that, uh-oh, Jeremy's on TV. What news is he breaking? What information am I getting? It's not always about numbers. It's not always about who hits a home run or who scores a game-winning touchdown. It's, hey, you know, many of you didn't know this, but player X just donated $10,000 to this charity and didn't want to know about it, but we found out about it and thought this was too good of a story not to let you know about.
Yeah, I mean, listen, these two guys are, you know, sort of like the you know, they represent sort of the best of what ESPN does. And Bob Lee, I wonder what ESPN is going to look like without him, because he,
right,
he essentially has been, this is not my phrase, but phrase that others there have said, sort of he's the conscience of ESPN, he's a journalistic conscience. And when he retires, which isn't long away, you wonder what's going to happen. I mean, Shap probably sort of goes into that role, but there are certain guys you can't really replace. Like, you can't replace Cronkite at CBS. You can't replace, the McNeil Era Report. You know what I mean? Like, the show will go on, but the show is going to be inevitably different when he walks away.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. It's like when Charles Kuralt walked away.
Perfect example. That's actually a great example.
And that was, what was that, Sunday Today?
Sunday morning. Sunday morning. That's a better example than mine.
CBS Sunday morning show. Like, it was never the same after that.
The show goes on, but it's just right. It's not
the
same.
But you even noticed that, because you had Bob Lee on the phone, and I wanted to jump in, but the interview was flowing so nicely that I didn't want to just, like, jump in with a, you know, and... not an asinine question, but more like of a joke
question.
You're
welcome to jump.
Because I wanted to ask Bob Lee, whatever happened to Seth Hayes? Now, if you don't know who Seth Hayes is, Seth Hayes is a character from This Is SportsCenter commercial, but years ago.
I don't know who Seth Hayes is.
And Bob Lee is the not the focal point, but he's the guy who starts the commercial off. And he says, you know, we check out high schools, we check out colleges, and sometimes we find that one prime candidate, and it's like a young kid who comes in to try to anchor SportsCenter, and he just totally blows this opportunity. So then he's like, well, you know, and then he holds a press conference afterwards, and he's like, I regret that I have to, you know, resign from my position at SportsCenter. I'm not ready. So it's almost like when you bring a kid up from the minors too early and he doesn't perform well.
That's one you can get on YouTube.
Yeah, I'll show it to you after this episode. After we're finished with this.
Just Google that if you want to hear it.
Oh, my God. It's so funny. It's This Is SportsCenter. I think it's either the kid or just type in Seth Hayes. The kid's name is Seth Hayes. It's Jack Edwards and Seth Hayes sitting at the SportsCenter desk. And the kid just becomes unhinged.
That's funny.
On SportsCenter. It's funny.
I sort of remember that.
The classic line from that one is Jack Edwards is saying, Jimmy Key gave up, and then the kid interrupts Jack Edwards and goes, Jimmy Key, what is he, like 40? What is he, like 50? I can hit him. And you see Jack Edwards' face, he's like, oh, kid, I think you're messing up.
Wow, Jimmy Key reference. And Jack Edwards still doing Bruins games.
Absolutely. But go ahead. I'm sorry, Dad. I had to cut you off.
No, that's all right. I'm basically just going to give the recap. All right. So we thank Bob Lee and Jeremy Schapp. Previous podcasts have been Royce Young of ESPN.com. He's got an amazing story about he and his wife and his family that I recommend. James Andrew Miller came in to talk about the ESPN layoffs. Amy Trask of CBS Sports, the former Raiders CEO. Kevin Harlan of Turner Sports, and prior to that, Bob McCowan, Dave Meltzer, the great wrestling reporter. And please check the archives out at the Media Podcast with Richard Deitch. A lot of these interviews, I think they're evergreen, as we say in the business, so you could sort of listen to them because they're talking about their process. It's not always tied to the news. My thanks to my producer, as always, Lou Pellegrino. Thanks to the guys at Digital Media. Thank you to Sports Illustrated and the editors and management there who support these podcasts. And please check out the other podcasts for Sports Illustrated as part of the Digital Media Network. All right. We'll be back next week, and we'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.